This is Friday, the 6th of August. This is the second lecture at the New Church Assembly. My topic is a general introduction to the kingdom period, and my name is Bill Wolfenden. Got it all out. How about that? In the year 1749, a volume appeared in print with no author's name on it called Arcana Caelestia. And we have now the third edition of that, 1949. This is the Latin in which Swedenborg wrote. And this was followed, of course, by many, many other volumes. And I want to read just briefly the introduction to this book. You'll be grateful to know I'm going to read it in English. He wrote, "The Word of the Old Testament contains heavenly arcana with every single detail focusing on the Lord, His heaven, the church, faith, and what belongs to faith, but no human being grasps this from the letter. Judging it by the letter or sense of the letter, nobody views it as anything more than a record in the main of external features of the Jewish church. Yet at every point there are internal features that are nowhere evident in the external, apart from the very few which the Lord revealed and explained to the apostles, such as that sacrifices mean the Lord, that the land of Canaan and Jerusalem mean heaven, which is therefore called Canaan, and the heavenly Jerusalem, and that paradise is similar in meaning. But that every single detail, even the smallest, down to the tiniest jot, means and embodies matters that are spiritual and celestial, is a truth of which the Christian world is still profoundly ignorant. And for that reason, it pays insufficient attention to the Old Testament. Nevertheless, they are able to know this truth from the single consideration that because the Word is the Lord's and derives from Him, it cannot possibly exist if it does not contain within itself such things as belong to heaven, the church, and faith. If this were not so, it could not be called the Word of the Lord, nor be said to have any life within it. For where does its life originate except in those things which belong to life, that is, in having every single detail go back to the Lord, who is life itself? Therefore, anything that does not interiorly focus on Him has no life. Indeed, any expression in the Word that fails to embody Him within itself or does not in its own way go back to Him is not divine. Without such life, the Word as regards the letter is dead, for it is the same with the Word as it is with man, who, as the Christian world knows, is internal as well as external. The external man, if parted from the internal man, is just a body and therefore dead. It is the internal man which lives and imparts life to the external. The external man is the soul of the external, the internal man is the soul of the external man. The same applies to the Word, which as to the letter alone is like the body without a soul. As long as the mind confines itself to the sense of the letter alone, one cannot possibly see that its contents are such. Take, for instance, these first sections of Genesis. From the sense of the letter, the only subject matter people recognize is the creation of the world and the Garden of Eden, which is called paradise, and Adam is the first man to be created. Who thinks anything different? The fact that these things contain arcana, however, which have never been revealed up to now, will be sufficiently clear from what follows, especially clear from the fact that the subject matter of Genesis number 1 is in the internal sense, the new creation of man, that is, in general, his regeneration, and in particular, the most ancient church. And the subject is presented in such a way that not the smallest part of any expression fails to have a representation, carry a spiritual meaning, or embody something within itself. But unless he has it from the Lord, no human being can possibly know that this is the situation. By way of introductory remarks, therefore, it can be disclosed that in the Lord's divine mercy, I have been allowed constantly and without interruption for several years now to share the experience of spirits and angels, to listen to them speaking, and to speak to them myself. I have been allowed, therefore, to hear and see astounding things in the next life which have never come to any man's knowledge, not even entered into his imagination. In that world, I have learned about different kinds of spirits, about the state of souls after death, about hell, the miserable state of people who do not have faith, about heaven, the very happy state of those who do have faith, and above all else, about the doctrine of the faith that is acknowledged in the whole heaven. In the Lord's divine mercy, more will be told about these matters in what follows. And that, of course, was going to continue for many years to give us what we call now the writings of the new church. Well, it was with these words that Swedenborg introduced his theological works to the world. And it is really a brief but quite concise summary of what has often been called the principle of correspondence. And it is fundamental to our lecture theme this week. Our theme is geographical correspondences. And although it is likely that most of the lectures presented will focus in part on some aspects of the literal narrative of the Bible, it is my presumption that such relating of the literal story will generally serve as a jumping-off place for a look at some aspect of the deeper or spiritual sense, which is our main concern. Some time ago, I compiled what I called a one-page spiritual sense outline of the word, based in part on earlier work by Anthony Regamy and others. Like most charts, it contains some basic truth, but at the same time, by the very nature of a chart, it falsifies truth in a number of ways. I'll get a look at it. I had hoped to make some copies of this, but I never got around to doing it. It's here somewhere. Here it is. But we'll talk about it in a little bit of detail just to get us going here. It falsifies truth in first, it appears to be complete and unambiguous, which it is not. Two, it breaks the human life cycle down into 9 more or less arbitrary consecutive time units, which is far from the truth about human life in general. Third, it implies that the spiritual progression of every human individual is straight line and directly relatable to the biblical narrative in terms of steps of growth, which is hardly true. Fourth, it again implies that therefore you or I or anyone else ought to be able to bracket our particular present stage in our total life cycle and pinpoint the particular segments of, wherever the next page is, the biblical narrative that is most likely to be relevant to our present spiritual state, which of course is nonsense. Let's just look at the chart for a moment. In this column, it takes all the books of the Bible that we consider those books that have an inner sense. On this side, it briefly describes the states that relate most directly to that. So what we've got here, we begin with Genesis, the beginnings from creation to the time of Joseph, the creation, Adam, Noah, Babel, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Egypt, Joseph, Exodus, Israel led out of Egypt, given the commandments, the tabernacle, Moses, Leviticus and ceremonial law, Numbers, the census, of course, the wilderness wandering, and Deuteronomy, the laws are retold, which is what Deuteronomy means, and the death of Moses. Well, I've linked those to spiritual beginnings, formation of the soul, or if you will, the spiritual body, that remarkable thing we call remains, those things that remain with us, impressions of spiritual value. The prenatal and early infancy stage is the innocence of ignorance, but along with this, the assertion of inherited tendencies. It's amazing how quickly these come out, even in babies. Instinct versus intellect. The heart and mind are still pretty much separate. but there's a heavenly environment surrounding the infant. Then later infancy and childhood, this is the time when children get the idea of God and something they don't particularly like called obedience, the leading by parental influence, the development of a sense of right and wrong, self-assertion, but also conflicts, dreams, idealism, the hunger of the mind, and what we call memory knowledges, the first joy of learning and discovering life. And during this, we have what we call childhood instruction, habits form, deeper learning, self-discipline, that's the tough one, the meaning of freedom, natural knowledge and training, wilderness, law and order, Decalogue, precepts, repetition, assimilation, heart, mind, advance, God and the neighbor. And then we move on to Joshua with the conquest of Canaan, the book of Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, where we deal with adolescence. Truth used in struggle to gain an ideal spiritual life. And to some degree, a gradual conquest of self and hereditary tendencies. And then there's also the chaos of youth, an unsettled period, alternating submission to the ways of the world, and then sudden better impulses that deliver them from that, search for a ruling motive in life. And there are defeats and there are victories. And this develops a sort of an ideal of youth, harking back to childhood, emerging to new but still insufficient power. It's an awkward age. There are problems of self-guidance and a desire for integration. And then we move on into the books of Kings, the Psalms, prophets, and we have, I've labeled this early maturity. This is the time when we have a sort of an inner demand for controlling ideas, a governing principle. First, ideals are enthroned based on our own idea about spiritual life. And then, as time goes on, they are more, what we say, after God's heart. The whole nature is brought together out of a desire to worship the Lord in life. There's early success in trial to make our ideal real, followed by some division yet of will and understanding. The word, and this is mostly in the books of the prophets, shows power but also reveals great weakness in spiritual purpose when the issue is God or self. Sometimes it's pretty hard to put God ahead of self. Finally, life goes captive to worldly engrossment. First the mind, then the heart. You know the truth, but you don't do it. This is a time of breakdowns, of inner maladjustments, of temptations and victories, of insights into the consequences of evil, in disillusion about oneself, of hope, of development of conscience, and finding no help within yourself, and seeing the need for deliverance and looking for divine redemption. And this finally leads us to the New Testament and the Gospels, which I've labeled maturity. The Savior comes. His birth in us is our second birth. His ministry reaches into all parts of our being, revealing self to us, claiming our undivided allegiance, teaching, healing, the law of love. It's the first phase of a new life and reformation, which is outward active shunning of evil. And finally, with the book of Revelation, maturity into old age, regeneration proper, conscious regeneration. There are now more subtle trials of inner life. It deals more with motives, the plane of causes, the realization that one is a spiritual being, that heaven is within, that the glorified Christ is in control of all life, and we begin to realize what the descent of the New Jerusalem really means. And it leads to what we can call a regenerate nature. This will be available if any of you'd like to look at it later, but I just wanted to get that before us. If in fact any or all of the above points were really true, then the study of the kingdom period, according to my chart, would be of direct use only to those in the time of life my chart calls the ideal of youth. Defined or explained in these words, harking back to childhood, emerging to new but insufficient power, awkward age, problems of self-guidance, desire for integration. And to help put it in clearer perspective, the preceding period, linked to the biblical period of the judges, I called the chaos of youth, and the one following, related to the end of the kingdom period and the time of the divided kingdom of Israel, Judah, is called early maturity. However, what my chart fails to take into consideration, among other things, is that the deeper senses of the Bible contain cycles within cycles, and that in one sense, every part of the word is relevant to everyone's life at all times. For instance, in the creation story in the beginning of the book of Genesis, there is a complete picture of the whole human life cycle. A little further on, in the narrative beginning with the Exodus from Egypt and culminating in the occupying of Canaan, we have another full life cycle series. And this, of course, is our particular topic this week. Seen in the proper light, both the Ten Commandments and the blessings cover the whole of life by themselves. But then if we consider the blessings as part of the Sermon on the Mount, they drop their role of completeness in favor of being an integral part of that larger summary of life which the sermon comprises. Now that I have perhaps made sufficient apology for the appearances of truth inherent in my chart, let me briefly come to its defense and make the following assertion. The kingdom period, that time when Israel was under the leadership in turn of Saul, David, and Solomon, does involve, in its deeper meaning, a clear-cut relationship to a tradition, to a transition period in human life, no matter what the particular chronological age of the individual involved. There's no question that this particular sort of transition is typical of young people moving out of the years of adolescence into the years of early adult life. But to suggest that this sort of transition is limited to that stage of life would be to misunderstand grossly the power and versatility of the Word of the Lord. Thus, for instance, in the lesson titled Asking for a King in the Dole Bible Study Notes, we find both of the following statements. In a brief paragraph addressed to teachers of the senior class, meaning senior high school age, I quote, "The meaning of asking for a king comes close to the thinking of the seniors, and the teachers urge to stress the correspondence of the leadership of truth separated from good and the hardships it imposes. Then the teachers advise to prepare the way for later lessons by suggesting that we may find that our first understanding of truth is not altogether reliable. Be sure they understand the continuing function of Samuel." And that's the end of that first quote. Now, earlier in this same lesson, but here in notes addressed to parents rather than to teachers, we find these words, "Most of us mean to be good people. We believe there is a God and that we ought to do right. And most of us believe that the Bible is in some way the Word of God. This is like the people's recognition of Samuel as the Lord's prophet. But this world and its demands seem very important to us, just as they did to the Israelites. And we cannot be quite satisfied to go on just obeying the commandments from day to day without seeing what they are accomplishing for us. We want some big striking principle to follow which will make us powerful with those around us in the world. This is asking for a king. And the Lord never interferes with our freedom of choice. He understands all our weaknesses and does his best to lead us in the right direction, warning us of difficulties ahead and helping us to learn even from our own mistakes." That was the end of the second quote. And this latter statement, of course, is obviously addressed to people in their adult years, while the former one is patently for teenagers. And what is remarkable, both are true and appropriate within their own context. William Bruce writes in part on this transition period as follows: "It is the Lord's desire that his church and his children should live and act under the government of his love, to which his truth is subordinate and instrumental. This," he writes, "is the perfection of order. Into this order man was created. Into this order man is still providentially initiated in his infancy and childhood. When man first departed from the law of love, it was because he would not have a God of love to reign over him. And when man desired to be ruled by the law of truth rather than the law of love, the Lord granted him his desire. But he granted it as a thing he permitted rather than that he willed, and as a temporary rather than a permanent condition. We know that whatever principle rules in the human mind and thence in the church and in the world, it makes all things subservient to itself. The kingly rule in Israel was a type of rule of intellect rather than of affection. And whenever religion becomes a matter chiefly of the intellect, the goods and truths of the word are employed to advance the glory of man more than the glory of God. As the sons of Israel were to be taken by the king for charioteers and horsemen, so the truths they represented are used by the intellectual person to aid in intellectual conflicts and exalt personal intellectual displays. As their daughters were to be taken for confectioners and cooks, so the affections of good which they represented are made to minister to the appetites and passions, according to them gratification suited to their sensual desires." And that's the end of that section from Bruce. Mention was made earlier of the role of Samuel in this transition. It should be noted in passing that although Samuel does not appear in the book of Judges, he is in fact the last of the judges, and unlike his several predecessors, was the only one of the judges to have gained nationwide acceptance. He has sometimes been described as the first of the circuit judges. And as such, he did bring a degree of unity to the nation that it had not known since the days of Joshua. Another important factor to consider in understanding why the kingdom period was inevitable was that the Philistines had begun to become more than a local nuisance in the days of Samuel. Previously, almost all problems with enemies had been local and scattered. Now the Philistines emerged as a national threat. And despite his obvious strength, Samuel was not seen as a military leader by the people, hence their demand for a king to fight their battles. But there was more behind the demand than the fear of the Philistines. Samuel was getting along in years, and he had appointed his two sons to be judges in Beersheba. Sadly, however, we read they did not walk in his ways, but took bribes and perverted judgment. And it was probably as much fear that Samuel's sons would succeed him as it was fear of the Philistines that led the people to come to Samuel and plead that he appoint a king over Israel to rule by decree and to lead them in battle. We need to realize that this was an extraordinary request. Israel, up to this time, had been a theocracy, a nation under the direct rule of God, with leaders appearing more or less spontaneously in response to particular crises. No one up to this time had ever actually ruled the whole of the nation. Each tribe had its own regional government leaders, who in times of uncertainty usually went to the high priest or to a known seer to ask for assistance in seeking God's guidance. But now the priesthood was falling into disrepute, and the time seemed ripe for a new type of leadership. And so dawned the kingdom period of Saul, David, and Solomon. And here I end my presentation, and the floor is yours. And I'm going to sit down, if I may.
He handed me the microphone, so I guess I better say something.
You better say something, yeah.
Just a comment on one of your later statements, and that is there was another reason that I recall that they wanted a king. I don't know if you want to comment on this or not, but they said, we will be like all the other nations.
Right. Yes, because, again, other nations were, in a sense, ahead of them there. That they already had kings, and it was a sort of a social thing that, well, we ought to have one too, don't you think?
Peer pressure.
Yeah, but as I say, there were several pressures there, and not the least of which was the nature of the sons of Samuel that they were afraid of. That's all I want to say about
the
it.
The peer pressure thing, I sometimes talk about that because it seems like if everybody else is doing it, it must be good. And yet there's also the statement in the Bible, thou shalt not follow a crowd to do evil. So we're in the tension between that. And what are we really supposed to be following? Are we supposed to be following what everybody else does?
Right.
Or what God is telling us to do?
One thing perhaps didn't make clear is that no matter when we reach into these several stages, I think we all have to go through them in more or less in order. It's sort of a good exercise for you individually, personally, to say, well, where do you suppose I am in this series? And if I could sort of pinpoint where I am in this nine-step progress, as I put it out, what do I need to do? What do I need to be aware of? What do I need to look especially for in myself so that I may grow properly, spiritually, and complete the cycle? Jason.
I'm guessing that cycle also works recursively in your own life when you have a problem. Sometimes you start at the first stage. You see it that way?
Oh, yeah, sometimes we may go back a few steps. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying I can see my life as a progression through those stages, but also in each particular issue, I may go through those stages to work through that particular issue.
Right. It cycles with, I think I mentioned cycles within cycles,
yeah.
Is typical of our lifespan. But it's of some use to know there is a general pattern and that we need to be aware that that's the Lord's intent, that we somehow, in some way, make progress through that total pattern. Yeah, it's like some of those puzzles you work on. It takes some time.
There's a puzzle we're working on that is a picture of an owl, but it's made up of all sorts of a mosaic of all sorts of little pictures of all different things.
Yes.
A little bit like that.
That's why I stay away from it. It's perfectly possible to have a nice extended break if you'd like, but I'm available if you want to raise any more questions or thoughts.
I had one thought that was occurring to me that is not really on this topic, but more a question, and that is the placement of the Psalms. It relates more to your earlier rundown of the various parts of the Bible, and I think that the order we have is probably right, but I wonder if anybody here who's studied the matter has any opinions as to whether the Psalms are in the right place or whether they should go after the prophets for the spiritual story.
I don't have any thoughts about it. I don't know if anybody else has.
One of those abstruse questions, but it's kind of fascinating. I guess the only reason that I would think they might be the other way is when Jesus is talking to the gathered disciples after the resurrection, the order he places them in is the law and the prophets and the Psalms.
And the Psalms, yeah.
And they were in the third division of Hebrew scripture.
Yeah. Ken, were you raising your hand about that?
I was just wondering if there wasn't maybe a similar situation, how the period of kings stated again in Chronicles,
yeah,
and how they actually, by the limitations of physical writing, they have to come one after the other, but they're actually about some restating of what happened. And it's that there's some real similarities between the prophets and the Psalms, and that there's lots of good things that happened and lots of terrible things that happened, and celebrations and warnings, and the Psalms are full of that kind of thing too. And I'm wondering if they aren't, even though they occur sequentially, if they aren't actually correspondentially referring to a time in life where all of those things were happening together.
I believe so, yes. We also need to be aware that, as you mentioned, the Chronicles are not included in the canon of the New Church, if you will, as having an inner sense. And yet they're there. It's interesting the number of books that are in the Bible that Swedenborg skips over and says these, he doesn't say it in so many words, but he ignores them. He says he doesn't treat them as having an inner, deeper sense. And yet I feel there must be a providence that the Bible came together the way it did, and that we shouldn't just ignore books like Chronicles simply because Swedenborg did.
Yeah, I think it does need to be recognized that the prophets historically are simultaneous with the kings, but I read that as saying that when we have come through, when we have met this terrible crisis of the destruction of Jerusalem, then we look back on that and see our whole, everything that's led up to that in a very different light. And it, to me, it became immensely striking. All through 2 Kings, you have this focus on worship and worship in the temple and so on and so forth, and everything hinges on that. You turn to the first chapter of Isaiah, and it says, God is saying, I am sick of your sacrifices. I can't stand it anymore. Your incense stinks.
Right, right.
This was an actual theme during all this period of Kings. The prophets were saying this, but they don't say it in the books of Kings. We don't wake up to this until we've come through the crisis and have to look back and say, what on earth, how did I blow it so bad?
Right, right, yeah, very helpful, thanks. Before we do adjourn, as a member of the board of the Swedenborg Foundation, these little propaganda sheets were put out on the seats. I think you'll find it of interest if you're online. Because of the length of the URL here, it should all fit together, newcenturytv.com/Swedenborg. There's no space there. And unfortunately, at the moment, unless you have Internet Explorer 6 on your computer, or if you can download it, you can reach this page. But if not, I had 5.5 on mine and couldn't reach it with that. I don't use Explorer. I use Netscape. But I've talked to our director at the Swedenborg Foundation, and she's going to talk to these New Century TV people and see if they can broaden the level of access so that you can use the browser you like and that you prefer to use. It seems to me an unnecessary limitation.
And also they address it only to the PC people.
Right.
I think that we would
Mac people are,
the way that we would address everybody. It's
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Mac. Yeah, yeah. If you happen to be on the mailing list with Logos, it was a front page news on the last issue, and no apology whatever for the fact that unless you had Explorer 6, you couldn't get to that page anyway. And if you happen to have a Mac, you can't get to it anyway. So,
you have,
but if you're interested and you have a Mac, hold on to this slip, and maybe Deborah will be able to do something about it. Well, I thank you for your attention. Yes, Lee.
Well, we ought to ask the question, why is the foundation funding something?
It's over there, yeah.
So, obviously,
we do have a little more time.
Oh, we got lots of time, yeah.
And What you said reminded me that right at the end of one of my lectures, he brought up an issue about the
exclusive focus on the temple, and that was the critical issue. But then that changing in the prophet period, and I'm glad Dorothea is here now because it reminded me of a lecture that she had given earlier about Ahab and Jezebel, and how there was an incompatibility between their two worldviews, that each one of them, correct me along the way, Dorothea, if I get this wrong, but that each one of them came from a position that was valid within his or her own worldview, but the world was changing, and Jezebel's view had to be left behind, which was essentially the king was an absolute ruler, and he should be able to do what he wants. But the Israelite worldview was that the king is under the law of God and serves as the executor of the law, not as the law. And that tied in with this idea that for the time that the temple existed, it was proper for those people to worship the temple because that was the law of their God. But society moved forward just as we individually move forward. And you can't stay in that state. There is a state in our life when abiding by a fixed principle that we see as supreme is the most important thing. Honesty is the best policy, or whatever we happen to pick. This is what's going to be the guiding principle of my life. And it brings us a certain order and structure and does expand our horizons, just as the kingdom expanded out to its maximum boundaries under David, the king representing that principle guiding our life. But as a matter of fact, in that is only one stage in the course of spiritual development, and we have to move beyond simply having a principle be the guiding force of our life. And it's very hard for us to let go of that. It worked pretty well while it was there, and so then we have this whole chaotic period of the prophets and having to prepare for a new and different phase of life, which is represented by the Lord coming in. Because after the kingdom period, there really isn't anything in the Old Testament that we consider to be canon, the Word of God, that doesn't relate to that in some way or to the captivity that followed. The time between that and the New Testament is blank in the canonical works. In the non-canonical works, there's Ezra and Nehemiah and some of those, and Maccabees and some of those books that tell the story of what happened in between, but that's not part of the spiritual story. And when we get to the New Testament, there is a whole new phase of life that isn't based around a king, a principle. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world." And so there had to be, it was good enough while it lasted, but it had to change and go on to the new phase. And that's a little different than saying that it was evil. It's saying it was good but not eternal. Yeah. It was good but it's not going to last forever. You need to move on.
That's why I like to pick on honesty is the best policy, because a better one might come along. George wants to say on this.
I can't resist a little pedantic note. In the word explained, which was the first thing we looked at in terms of the interpretation of the Bible, he was drawing on different translations, particularly one by a man named Castellio and then Schmidt. And I had a chance to look at Castellio and discovered that Castellio was upset by the fact that there was this great blank in the after the exile. So he filled it in with Josephus. And he, at the end, he says, "Now, I don't want to, I'm not claiming that Josephus is scripture, and if you don't want to read it, you don't have to." But he wanted the story to be continuous.
Right, right. Yeah, we need that feeling of continuity. You hit another nerve in Lee.
That just reminds me so much of what they did in, I think, the Roach edition of the Apocalypse Explained.
Oh,
is that the right one? There are two versions of the...
Not the Roach.
Which one was it?
A whole separate publication.
A whole separate publication. Which one was it?
I don't recall.
At any rate, Swedenborg wrote two commentaries on the Book of Revelation. One of them comes out to six volumes in English and was never completed. It ground to a halt in Revelation 19, verse 10, I believe it was. The other one he actually published, that was Apocrypha Revealed. Well, one of the groups that published Apocrypha Explained just couldn't stand the fact that it wasn't complete. So they took, when they got to Revelation 19:10, the whole rest of it they just took out of Apocrypha Revealed and published that in there as the rest of the work. That's right. The Roach published only the published the ones that Swedenborg published. So it couldn't have been the Roach.
Yeah, I should. I used to, but I forgot.
That's a psychological principle.
Just to continue with
Lars Rem.
It's like the psychological Lars principle Rem of you can draw a circle and not quite make it complete, and then everybody will, you know, you want to finish it.
Complete the circle.
I like that story about the finishing up the AU.
Thank you, thank you.